You are listening to Main Street Blues by the Red Stick Ramblers from their album Main Street Blues. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host for a Sound Health Show on VBS Radio. And for the next hour, well, we're going to be talking to some very exciting people, bring you new information, and give you some conversation that we hope will provide options and information for self-health. I think the Main Street Blues song is very appropriate because what we're going to bring to you is bringing it information to the forefront of what's happening now, and it's about sacrificing our children's health in the name of national security and keeping us all safe. We're going to be talking to David Kirby, author and award-winning book Evidence of Harm. It's about mercury in vaccines and the autism epidemic, a medical controversy. Part of inviting David Kirby on is because we had a guest recently who had written a book, and in it is the premise that autism is increased only because we have better funding and better diagnostics. And the book was Unstrange Minds, a very nice book that blends anthropological facts with autism in other countries, and it's a nice story about a father whose own daughter has autism. But one of the things that disturbed me in his book was a quote in the beginning, and it says, "An increasing number of them," meaning parents, "are choosing to withhold much-needed vaccinations for their children out of the fear that they will contract autism, although a connection between vaccinations and autism has never been firmly established." It's my personal opinion, this is my soapbox here, that this is not something that can be contracted, that autism is not a disease but a result, and that's my opinion. And we have on standby Dr. Rebecca Carley. She's been on the show before. She's an MD and a court-qualified expert in vaccine-induced disease. And I want to make an announcement here about VBS Radio. VBS Radio is for the people. Doug and Don Newsom have set it up so that no censoring will take place. They've been taken off the air many times when there's been a controversial subject due to electrical or internet issues, but we always come right back on, and we're recording this as we speak. It's going to be run several times, and I also need to admit that I am very prejudiced here because I have two damaged grandchildren from vaccination, and one is a recovered autistic. We were able to trace it down. It was a shot, hepatitis, that caused the autism, and we were able to reverse it. And another one, grandchildren, suffered from thrombocytopenia, low platelet count. And when this happened, it's like bleeding under the skin if they're touched. And we rushed her to the hospital only because her mother was afraid to. She thought the welfare people would take her away from the mother because she just looked like she had been beat. And the most horrible part of this, the side effect, was listed as a minimal risk. And this baby was bleeding internally. And when I got her to the hospital, I didn't even stop at the front desk. I just barged in the back room and shoved her into the nearest doctor's arms. And she was bleeding to death. She was going to die. And the bad thing, I think, is that the physician knew immediately what had happened, what shots she'd had, and they kept her in the hospital for a long time trying to undo this. So we're going to bring Dr. Kirby on in just a few minutes. He is an he's received lots of awards. He's an investigative reporter, and he's received an award for investigative reporters and editors for careful and meticulous, I'm reading this now, meticulous reporting in his book about the evidence of harm on thimerosal and autism. He's one of the finalists for the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Award for excellence in journalism, and this is an award for drawing attention to important current issues. And I just found out today that the book, Evidence of Harm, is being made into a movie, so we can talk about that too. Dr. Kirby, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be on the show.
You're welcome. I'm not a doctor, however.
Okay.
You can call me David, that's fine.
Okay.
I'm a journalist.
Evidence of Harm is a very meaty book. I love what I've read so far, and I think just this government cover-up that you're talking about, I just think is incredible. And it's to help people who've lived the nightmares, and this is my opinion, Ian, and the government is trying to just push it under a rug. You give both sides. And Dr. Carly, who's on standby with us and listening to the show, she has some questions for you, so I'm delighted that she's going to be with us. So not only bringing the attention to the plight of these parents and what's happening and what's being covered up, but she helps fix them. And so she's been on the show with us before, so she's going to come in a little later. This idea of bearing this issue and the damage from vaccinations, is this why you wrote this book?
Well, what got me interested in this whole topic was actually the political aspects of it. I really didn't know anything about vaccines or autism. It had to do with the Homeland Security Bill, which was passed in November of 2002. The Homeland Bill in the House of Representatives, a secret rider basically had been snuck in at the last minute that would have dismissed lawsuits against Eli Lilly and other large drug companies for having put this vaccine preservative called thimerosal into childhood vaccines in the United States, which people suspected, parents were suspecting at the time, might have contributed to their children's autism. This was all news to me, and what struck me was the way in which the bill, the writer was inserted into the bill, the secrecy with which it was done, and it just seemed like people with nothing to hide don't behave in that kind of way. If these drug companies and their supporters in Congress, in this case Republicans, were not concerned about lawsuits over mercury-containing vaccines, I believe they never would have acted in this way. And it got me suspicious, and I started looking into it, and that's when I stumbled across an entire community of thousands of parents, probably now tens of thousands of parents who do believe that mercury in some way contributed to their children's illness.
I know with Homeland Security, they forced a lot of armed forces people to take these shots. Some of them have refused and been charged with treason. Some of them have left the services with dishonorable discharges. I know in our local hospital here, our people refused to take the smallpox vaccination. It was, you know, people were dropping dead from heart attacks from it. Do you see that your book has changed anything about Homeland Security and what's happening?
No, I wouldn't say that. And it was really the politicians who were trying to tie childhood vaccination in with Homeland Security and bioterrorism when they're really two different things. Diphtheria and whooping cough are not bioterrorist weapons. They're epidemics. And I think what some people were trying to do was sort of tie them together and say, we need to provide litigation protection to vaccine makers. And it was interesting because at the time they said, they even brought up smallpox and anthrax, and that vaccine makers need to feel free to produce those products without the threat of litigation. And what these allies in Congress tried to do was connect childhood vaccination with bioterror vaccination and provide blanket immunity to all companies. So they're kind of two different stories, even though they both involve vaccines.
Well, there's so much controversy about this. I just read an article about something going on in California, hepatitis, which they've quit, and three kids died from this hepatitis, but the year they gave shots, like 36 kids died. And that doesn't even make any sense.
I haven't seen that story. I'd be interested in seeing it.
They give the vaccine and more kids die than if they didn't.
Hmm.
So it's just kind of nuts, and I don't know what to believe. You see this story that says your book is wrong, and then if you read your book, it's meticulous in this cover-up and what was going on, and people won't come forward because they're afraid to lose their jobs. Can you talk a bit about what you discovered? I think it's one of the later chapters in your book about cover-ups.
Yeah, and I never personally use the word cover-up in my book, and people are free to interpret it any way they like, and that's certainly a popular interpretation. But there is evidence that government officials were less than forthcoming with information that they were sitting on, and evidence continues to emerge that I think some people certainly would label as some type of conspiracy or cover-up, at least among a small cadre of researchers here in the United States and in Europe. But basically, what those chapters I think you're referring to detail are a couple of the studies that were conducted by public health officials, again, here and in Europe, and the United States study looking at data of American children enrolled in HMOs that got varying degrees of mercury in their vaccines. And in the very early runs of the numbers, when they first started looking at this, they found significant risk, elevated risk for not only autism, but ADD, ADHD, tics, speech delay, et cetera, among children in the highest exposure categories compared to children who got a lot less mercury. We only know all this because of the Freedom of Information Act and because parents in my book with the group Safe Minds were able to acquire these documents. And for the first two or three generations of analyses, the signal, the association between thimerosal and autism was clear. And as they said themselves, it would not go away. Now, they did try to do various statistical things to try to reduce that signal and to reduce statistical significance, statistical power of their own data. We don't know why they did it, and no one's really been able to question them, and particularly under oath, about their methodology, but it's highly questionable. And in the end, in their final published report, which was the fifth generation, the fifth iteration analysis of data that took place over 4 years' time, they reported zero connection between autism or ADD in any of their analyses. And that's simply untrue. That is not a factual statement. There most certainly was an association in the earlier analyses. That study and that data was recently examined by a blue ribbon panel appointed by the National Institutes of Health. And their report, which was signed off by the director of the National Institutes of Health, said many, many things, but the bottom line was that this study was garbage and that they used bad data and they used it badly. And they explicitly laid out what was wrong with this whole study and how you might want to redo this study correctly, and that it was flawed and it was misleading. And yet that U.S. study conducted by the CDC is constantly pointed to as proof of exoneration of thimerosal's harm. Now, in Denmark, there was a similar study that also had many, many serious methodological flaws that I won't go into detail right at this moment, but suffice it to say that the lead author of the NIH panel study that looked at the CDC data, she told the press that as bad as the U.S. study was, the Denmark studies were even worse.
Well, the name of the chapter, I just looked it up while you were talking, Damn Lies and Statistics.
Well,
and reading
epidemiology is notoriously, you know, bad data in, bad data out. You can cut the numbers any number of ways and achieve a different result. And the fact is that this raw data has not been made available to outside researchers so that other scientists can take a look at what these government scientists did and try to replicate. Now, we can't replicate exactly what they did because the original data sets that they created to study have been lost or destroyed. They have gone missing, which incidentally could be a felony, a federal crime, and if someone is implicated in that, would spend a number of years in prison. These are taxpayer-funded data. It all starts to look like a conspiracy and cover-up, but the government seems to have a convenient excuse for everything.
Well, thank you for keep digging. I've read in your book what trouble you went to try to get to these basic statistics and these kids. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but what they did was go back and call out a certain population that would prove their premise.
Well, roughly speaking, that appears to be what they did. They did a number of things. First of all, they excluded any children who had congenital defects or birth defects or anything like that, which turned out to be 25% of the population. They just took them right out. And as the NIH panel suggested, these children, for all we know, might have been more at risk for autistic symptoms, and yet they were removed. Another thing they did was whatever the first diagnosis was, that was the clinical endpoint. In other words, if a child was diagnosed with speech delay, that was the final diagnosis. The child was removed from the study. Well, most children who have autism are first diagnosed with speech delay. All the kids in my book were first diagnosed with speech delay. If they had been taking part in the study, their autism never would have been counted. And on and on and on it goes. The other thing they did is they added in extremely young children. As young children were born and entered the HMOs, they were entered into the study, but they were far too young to have an autism diagnosis. Kids who were 0 to 1, 1 to 2, even 2 to 3, reported with, you know, in the youngest two categories, there were no autism cases whatsoever. Whereas in the older kids, the 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, there were plenty of autism cases. So by increasing the study population without increasing, you know, relatively amount of autism diagnoses, of course the relative risk went down. So there were a number of things that they did.
I have seen in some of the arguments that there's just more money for autism, so more doctors are being cooperative in providing that diagnosis. What do you say to that?
Well, I do believe that there is better diagnosis, better awareness, that we have expanded the diagnostic criteria. Because today when we talk about autism, we talk about ASD, autism spectrum disorder, not just full spectrum, so-called full-blown autism, but slightly milder forms down the spectrum, pervasive developmental disorder and Asperger's syndrome. Those weren't always counted as quote-unquote autism. As those all got grouped into the ASD category in many, many states, we definitely started to see the number of ASD or autism cases go up. This happened to coincide with the same time that the amount of mercury in vaccines started to really skyrocket as well. Parents don't typically go to the doctor begging for an autism diagnosis. That's just not the way it works. And autism diagnoses do not get handed out willy-nilly. There might be some doctors who do, but I don't think that's really what's driving this. I think there are more autism cases than ever before, and ADD and ADHD and learning disabilities and neurodevelopmental disorders. And talk to any school teacher who's been at it for 10 or 20 years, and they will testify that there are just far more many kids with special needs now than there ever was before, you know, in addition to autism. So I do think the numbers are going up, but I also do think that on the mild end of the spectrum, kids who might not have been diagnosed, who might not have received services 10 years ago, now probably are. And that is also because the services are there and the parents are going to avail themselves of it. So I think there's a lot at play here.
I have a series of questions to answer, but I'm debating telling you a story about one of the girls here that was pregnant, young girl. We followed her all through her pregnancy with vocal analysis and got the right nutrients for her. And she kind of laughed and played all through her labor. We're all standing around. And it took her like 3 pushes to deliver this baby. And on the second hard push, the nurse went around to her head and said, you do want your baby vaccinated, and Jessica's pushing, and the nurse says, I'll take that as a yes. And I went to the father, and I said, did you hear that exchange? And I knew they didn't want their baby vaccinated the same minute it was born.
Right.
So there's some sneaky, slimy stuff going on here, too.
Yeah, I've heard of children being vaccinated behind closed doors without the parents' knowledge. That, of course, violates all rules of informed consent. And even, I know, because I know some lawyers who are looking into this, human rights laws. You have a right to participation in your health care, or by extension, your child's health care, and to full informed consent, and to participate in the decision-making process. And to inform the parent after the fact is just not correct, to be honest. And I think public health people take it upon themselves to forgive me for saying it, for playing God here. And, you know, we're one of the only countries in the world that vaccinates anybody at birth. And we vaccinate for hepatitis B. There's a real uproar right now over vaccinating 12-year-old girls for HPV, where we vaccinate all children for hepatitis B at birth. And that's a sexually transmitted disease or a disease of IV drug users. Obviously, if the mother has antibodies, the child should be vaccinated. But otherwise, that child is probably not at risk of contracting hepatitis B, yet we vaccinate for it at birth. In most Western countries, they do that at 12 years old or at 16 years old, which is much more appropriate for the risk.
Well, it's just a point of vulnerability the moment they're born. And if it goes to court, it's going to be Jessica's word against this nurse. If I hadn't been watching the nurse, and we deliberately had me in there for that reason, we thought that was going to happen because her doctor was threatening her, saying, I won't take care of you if you don't get your kid vaccinated. And even after the six-week checkup, the doctor refused to see her or the baby again unless vaccinations took place. And so there's this whole challenge from the medical community. I think they've been very misinformed, and if I had the money, I'd buy them all a copy of your book and highlight certain passages and send it out. But a question to you, how's your book impacting what's going on with autism and the spectrum disorders and the community? How are people changing and looking at this now?
Well, slowly but surely, I think. 2 years ago when my book came out, it was absolute heresy to suggest anything but that autism is purely a genetic disorder and is not epidemic. It was heresy to suggest that there might be an environmental trigger occurring on top of a genetic predisposition. And it was certainly heresy to suggest that biomedical interventions might make children with autism improve. It was witchcraft. People laughed at me. And they're not laughing anymore. And, you know, I would like to think that my book had something to do with that. Now, that doesn't mean that vaccines have been implicated, or mercury even, but it does mean that the paradigm is shifting and that most reasonable people are now coming to the conclusion that autism is increasing and that there is an environmental component. Now, we can talk about some of the genetic studies that have just been done, and I'd be happy to, but just on the other side, I would present as evidence that things are changing. A couple of things. One is the most recent cover story of Discover Magazine, an article which outlines clearly all of the biomedical interventions that have been developed and seem to be having some effect on children and need to be studied more, including chelation therapy, the removal of mercury from the body, and dietary interventions and things like methyl B12 that seem to be improving some of these kids. You also have the Institute of Medicine, which only 2 years ago ruled out a connection between mercury and autism, but is now holding a two-day workshop in April in Washington on researching environmental factors in autism. And that's going to include mercury, and that's going to include vaccines. So if people tell you that this, you know, this story is over and that, you know, the jury has decided, I'm sorry about the dog, that it's just simply not true because the IOM will be looking into this. And finally, Autism Speaks, the largest autism organization in the country, has started to fund environmental research. They're holding a concert in New York City with Bill Cosby and Toni Braxton, the proceeds of which will all go into environmental research. And Autism Speaks, which was founded by Bob and Suzanne Wright, Bob was recently president of NBC Universal. Their daughter has an autistic son, and just today she issued a statement on the evidence of harm listserv that they are using biomedical interventions on her son. Her son is improving, and that she most definitely blames environmental factors for his illness. So that's all. Have a bit of a snowball effect, and I think help put the brakes on this effort to brand autism as a purely genetic disorder. And I think my book had a little bit of influence in some of those things.
Well, I know your book had a pivotal influence on our research here with autism when we looked at some of your research that you reported on glutathione and what was happening there.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, isn't it? You know, glutathione is a powerful antioxidant. And we know that children with autism have oxidative stress, and glutathione is also, of course, a sulfur-based protein, and sulfur has a natural affinity with heavy metals. Most people have high levels of glutathione on their bodies so that when they're exposed to mercury or lead, the glutathione basically captures it in their blood and helps them eliminate it through feces or urine or hair. Children with autism, and the research really bears this out, and again, get a copy of Discover Magazine if you don't believe me. Research has shown that children with autism lack glutathione. Now, glutathione belongs to a class of proteins called thiols. A synonym for thiol means mercaptan, and that comes from the Latin for mercury capturer. So children with autism are born without mercury captures, or for some other reason have depleted levels of glutathione, a mercury capturer, and then we start loading them up with mercury, and lo and behold, they show physical and cognitive and mental effects from the mercury, whereas typical children don't, because they do have glutathione and they are able to effectively excrete that mercury out of their body, basically preventing it from accumulating and preventing it from doing any permanent damage.
One of the things that we found here that might be helpful for your people is there's damage to the glutathione precursor so that it can't even be recognize and utilize. And when we provide those frequencies back to entrain the brain to kick in that gene, we see recovered autistics.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part. Damaged glutathione what?
Precursors.
Precursors.
The gene. The precursors.
Yes, well, like cysteine and homocysteine and others, that is absolutely true. And again, the work of Jill James in University of Arkansas and Dr. Richard Deeth at Northeastern University have shown that this all involves a little known process called methylation. Methylation, without getting too biochemical, is the transfer of one methyl group from one molecule to another, but it's absolutely essential in a number of things that go on in the body, including DNA expression, including nerve development, including development of the essential fatty acids that coat our nerves in our brains, such as the myelin sheath. And what they have shown is that in some kids with a certain genetic predisposition, the introduction of mercury seems to shut down methylation. And once you shut down methylation, you start to lower your levels of things like homocysteine and cysteine, and basically that cuts off the supply of glutathione because those are the precursors to glutathione, but they are a product of methylation. So without methylation, without proper methylation, you won't have enough homocysteine, you won't have enough cysteine, you won't have enough glutathione. And it is a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, but we're talking about the gene. The precursor gene is what's not been activated so the body can even deal with glutathione if it knew what it was. But I don't want to get too technical with the audience. I want to ask you a couple more questions, then we're going to bring in Dr. Carley. And these are just questions when we ask some parents what they would like to know about what was going on. It came up with, has anyone threatened you about this or anyone tried to silence you?
No, not at all.
Okay. Three questions, and maybe, I'm trying to decide whether Dr. Carly should come in here, but I want to introduce her in a certain way. Not everybody has damage. How do you explain that? What do you think of the Papilloma Project? And then Dr. Grinker's, these are the three questions that we'll talk about again. In Dr. Grinker's book, The Unstrange Minds, he was sponsored by the National Alliance of Autism Research.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that twice in your book, but really don't explain what it is or if you know if he really did or does that organization take sponsorship from the pharmacies.
Okay.
The pharmaceutical company.
Okay. I'll do my best.
Okay.
First question on why not all kids get sick is a great question. First of all, not everybody reacts the same way to mercury. Second of all, not everybody got the same amount of mercury prenatally and in their vaccines. But again, it would appear, and maybe this is what you were trying to get at, there's a genetic predisposition whereby these children are not, for whatever reason, producing high enough levels of glutathione and other thiols, mercury capturers. So that because of some genetic problem, they lack the same defenses that people in the general population have. So therefore, they would react much more severely to mercury than other kids because they don't have their metabolism in place. They don't have the ability to excrete this mercury the way other kids do or other people do. We also know that autism affects boys at a ratio of 4-to-1, and there is some laboratory research to suggest that mercury and testosterone, at least in the test tube, are very synergistic and that they're very deadly to neurons, whereas mercury and estrogen seems to have the opposite effect. It actually seems to be protective. Finally, we know, looking back at diseases such as acridemia, pink disease, which was caused by mercury in teething powders in the first part of the 20th century, only 1 in 500 children exposed to the teething powders came down with the disease. So that again would suggest some type of genetic predisposition to have a different reaction to mercury or a different ability to deal with mercury than most people. The second question was about Dr. Grinker, is that correct?
Yes, Richard Grinker's Unstrange Minds. His grant was from the National Alliance of Autism Research.
Well, NAR was established a number of years ago and has pretty strenuously rejected any environmental theory, particularly mercury vaccines, and has really followed the pursuit of genetic research and was responsible for one of the two recent large genetic studies, and has been somewhat hostile to parents who have put forth this theory and been slightly hostile even towards people like me. And NAR does accept money from drug companies quite a bit, and they sponsor quite a number of the studies that they fund. Recently, NAR was merged with Autism Speaks, which I mentioned earlier, which has also merged with Cure Autism Now. So the three largest now are one group. And I have reason to believe that Autism Speaks, you know, is and will be funding more and more environmental research. And they still have old NAR people on their board and on their scientific panels, and yet they're moving in that direction. So NAR no longer exists, and we will hope that further research that gets funded will look at not just the genetics, but also the environmental stuff.
Okay, I'm going to hold this last question about indemnification because somebody just handed me a question. And it says, thimerosal was taken out of dog vaccinations years ago. Aren't our children as important as our dogs? And I think what they're referring to is they found out that it caused breeding defects in the dogs. Because I read a piece, some of that. And I think that's just a comment because somebody who's listening somewhere is angry.
Yeah.
We do it for our dogs, but not our kids.
Well, there is still thimerosal in dog vaccines, I know, because I have a dog, and I checked at my vet's office, and sure enough, it's still in there. I believe it was taken out of cattle vaccines and horse vaccines, and you mentioned reproductive effects, and there is copious published evidence of the reproductive toxicity of thimerosal. The state of California recently had to rule on this, because Bayer wanted to remove thimerosal from the list of hazardous substances that cause reproductive harm, and the state of California said, no way. Again, they said the evidence is ample and overwhelming that thimerosal causes reproductive harm. Now, we're giving this substance to pregnant women right now, and it has not been studied. It's never been studied. And not only the mercury, but the flu shot. If you get go get any flu shot and look at the insert, look at the label, it says right there, this product has not been studied in pregnant women. The effect on fetuses is unknown, and this product should only be used when necessary.
But it's okay.
On pregnant women.
Yeah.
And yet they're lining up at the Walmart, you know.
Where do you suggest people get real information, the good stuff?
I think people need to read everything. They need to read what's on the CDC website and the FDA website and the American Academy of Pediatrics, and then they need to go to people on the other side of the debate. It depends on where they're coming from. If they're parents, a group like Generation Rescue has a lot of information on biomedical interventions. If you're concerned specifically about vaccines, there's the National Vaccine Information Center. Their website is 909shot.com. There's the National Autism Association. There's the group Save Minds. And there's even, you know, research being done. I mean, you can check out my website, evidenceofharm.com, with links to lots of the research being done at major universities around the country. Harvard, Northeastern, University of Washington.
I don't know what to believe. And on that note, I am going to bring in Dr. Rebecca Carley, but I want to read you something from her website, and it's drcarley.com, D-R-C-A-R-L-E-Y. And Dr. Carley and I share personal experience that we've had this happen to our family. And when you see it there at that level, then you begin to believe that our kids are being used as sacrifices for the benefit of the rest of the population, and I see it as like sacrificing the virgins for crops. You know, but I'm sort of on a soapbox here. But this is what it says in her one of the places in her very informative site, and this is a quote: although the symptoms of mercury poisoning have been described as identical to the symptoms of autism, it should be noted that most children who descend into the hellish state known as autism do so after an MMR vaccine. The MMR vaccine is one of the few vaccines that does not contain mercury. In fact, it never contained mercury. Thus, it is self-evident that the removal of mercury will not make vaccines safe. This is why the mercury is the only thing being addressed at all, because when people reading this paper realize that the very mechanism by which vaccines corrupt the immune system means that no vaccine is safe. Dr. Carley, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
I'd like to ask some of these questions to you, things like why doesn't everyone have adverse reactions?
Okay, let me start with that one. Everybody does get affected by vaccines. The only question is, how long will it take to manifest the damage? And that depends on the strength of your immune system from the get-go, from when you're born, and it's the immune system which you inherit from your parents. I have so many things I would like to discuss with David Kirby, and actually I'd like to invite you to be a guest on my show, David. I'm also going to be on this network starting this Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's April 29th, and perhaps you can read the documents on my website and email me if you would be willing to come on to my show, because my work proves that autism is actually subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. Have you ever heard of that?
Not that exact term, no.
Okay. Well, I would encourage you to read the documents on my website. I've been investigating this for 10 years, and although I was trained as a surgeon after my own son was brain damaged from vaccines, and I reversed his damage not by chelating him but by homeopathically detoxing the viruses, I went back into my medical books, and I actually found in various editions of Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, which is the Bible by which all medical students in the world are taught internal medicine, and they actually discuss subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which when you read the description, you realize it is autism. And what they did was they changed the name of the disease to hide the fact that this is becoming so epidemic. The information you gave was very important about the fact that only 1 in 500 children came down with autism back when they were actually putting mercury in powder and sticking it in their mouth. And the reason for that is because they were only giving a fraction of the vaccines now being given in today's schedule at that time. And that actually proves that it's not the mercury causing the autism. I'm not saying that mercury is not bad, and my protocol also teaches people how to detoxify mercury. I use homeopathy because I consider it much safer. But it is the viruses that corrupt the immune system and cause the autoimmune attack on the myelin as well as the nerve sheaths themselves. And that's the reason why none of these doctors ever take autoantibody against myelin blood levels. The few that do always find them. And it's not just autism, it's every autoimmune disease and cancer. It was very interesting that Sherry started by talking about the child that had thrombocytopenic purpura. Of course, that is an autoimmune attack against the platelets. Just like diabetes is an autoimmune attack on the pancreas, and arthritis is an autoimmune attack on the joints, and asthma is an autoimmune attack on the lungs, lupus is an autoimmune attack on your own DNA. And all of these things are caused by inoculations. And I am proving that with my protocol, whereby I teach people how to reverse all assaults they've been exposed to that they're aware of, not just vaccine viruses, not just mercury, but also pesticides, antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure that one reason they're not giving you more of a hard time is because your information is exactly what they want the people to believe. You know, they're fighting it and they're making it look like, oh my God, we're going to be exposed now, when actuality they can take the mercury out. Yes, that will be much better. Of course, what I explained to people, it's better to be shot with a six-shooter than an Uzi. So the less toxins you have being injected into your bloodstream as soon as you're born are better. But certainly it is not going to affect the autoimmune disease and cancer rate in this country. And I would just also suggest that you go to the link on my website that connects to the group Byron Child in Australia. You will be quite amazed as to the conflicts of interest between these various alphabet agencies and, you know, Bill Gates Foundation and all these different groups that are actually quoting each other as to how safe vaccines are. But, of course, nobody's going to actually investigate this for real, because were this to be revealed that inoculations are causing all autoimmune disease and cancer, as I claim, as I prove not only in my documents but in my protocol, where I have clients all over the world reversing all these conditions. But you see, they will have to then admit that they've known about it all these years, because as I said, in the medical books they changed the name of the diseases. As a matter of fact, sudden infant death syndrome is actually something called acute necrotizing hemorrhagic encephalomyelitis. And right in Harrison's they actually state, now what I'm saying of course is that once again they changed the name. This is the condition, the long name, and it's actually sudden infant death syndrome. And they describe this as a massive demyelination. So in other words, it's the same as autism, only it happens so fast that the entire brain turns to mush. And they actually state in there that this hyperacute form of this entity that they call this long name can be induced in animals by administration of the pertussis vaccine. So it's not just the measles vaccine that's causing demyelination. It's also the pertussis vaccine and now the hepatitis vaccine as well. Every vaccine has a side effect of seizures and other disorders. It's amazing to me how many parents contact me that have pets or people, because the same thing is happening in pets, so you might want to rethink getting all your dogs vaccinated. And I will be having as a guest on my show two veterinarians from Massachusetts that are totally on my page and trying to speak out to stop this Holocaust as well. So I could go on for days, actually, with all this information, but I really hope that you will check out my information. This shouldn't be a matter of, you know, an ego between people and saying, well, I'm right and you're wrong or something like that, because, as I said, mercury's bad. But, you know, you actually proved in your own information about this teething powder that it's not the mercury. And, of course, they have no business putting the mercury in there. It's a preservative. All they had to do to get rid of the mercury in the first place was put vaccines in single-dose vials. But if they'd have done that, then they wouldn't have been able to create this mercury fiasco down the road when all the parents started crying out and saying, I don't believe you, my child was normal, now they're flapping their hands and doing all this other stuff.
We don't have a lot of time left, and I have some really important questions to ask the two of you. We're getting a lot of people asking us about the papilloma, and is it safe? David, would you go first and comment on this big push toward every high school girl has to have this papilloma virus?
Oh, I'm in no position to comment on whether that vaccine is safe or not. I would just say I believe that parents should ultimately have the right to decide, and not some public health official in a state capital. Again, informed consent and participating in your own health care. If I would never advise a parent or a 13-year-old one way or the other about that vaccine, but I believe that they and not the state government should decide.
So you haven't done any research on that?
No.
Okay, I need to tell a short story about here in Ohio. They passed a law, and the health department is allowed to come into the school, examine the child, and put them on medication without parental consent. And we are just up in arms about it, and a lot of people are pulling their kids. We're starting homeschools because of it. And I am not a radical. My daughter is a high school principal, and she is just as up in arms about this as the parents are, because she sees it like you do, that it's a violation of personal rights. Dr. Carley, do you have any investigation or information about this papillomavirus and what parents should do?
Well, I actually have various studies by the Special Virus Cancer Project of all the laboratories around this country that are playing with viruses that cause cancer. And yes, HPV is the first virus that they're admitting causes cancer, but in these documents they talk about breast cancer viruses and all kinds of other viruses. I will just read to you what it says in Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, 6th edition, page 943. Rarely is prevention of infection per se considered to be an important goal of vaccination. In fact, asymptomatic infection after vaccine can serve to enhance and prolong the immune response. What they're saying is that they're inoculating you with disease. And when you actually critically analyze this whole concept of inoculating you with a virus that they're telling you is so dangerous that you have to be protected from it, as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather take my chances out there in the world and do everything I can do to boost my immune system, because I guarantee you this is going to cause the biggest epidemic of cervical cancer we have ever seen. And when it happens, they've already got their ducks lined up in a row for this one. They're going to say, oh, darn, we only put four subtypes of the HPV virus in that vaccine. If only we'd have put every one that's available. Because, you see, they're already protecting themselves and saying that it only protects against four varieties of the virus. So they're going to be causing an epidemic of cervical cancer with this vaccine. And the idea that we can have, you know, some kind of government agent invade our child, I mean, if that's not abuse, I don't know what is. To have a child dragged out of their class and be forced to have anything done to them against their or the parents' consent. That's like Nazi Germany, basically.
We are running out of time. David, how can people get your book? How can they get in touch with you?
They can get my book at any of the major online booksellers, Amazon.com, and they can reach me at my website, evidenceofharm.com.
Are you available for talks and to help inform local as well as national organizations about this?
Yes, and again, you can reach me through the website for that.
Okay. Dr. Carley, do you have any final questions for Dave? I have 20 more questions, but we just don't have any time. Do you have any final questions for David?
Well, I'll just let the listeners know once again that I will be on BBS Radio every Thursday night at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I do invite David to be on my show because with his publicity that he's gotten, if he will just consider my information, and I've offered a $10,000 reward for any of these vaccine promoters to prove me wrong. Find me somebody to debate, and then you decide for yourself who's telling the truth, because we really have to do something about this. And my documents are on drcarley.com, drcarley.com, and of course the medical mafia has attacked me with a vengeance, just like they always do for anybody that hits the nail right on the head. So thank you very much, Sherry, for allowing me this opportunity. I'm honored to be on with David Kirby. I've read his book, and I'm very aware of his work, and I commend him for investigating the truth, but I just ask him, please, go that extra mile and just read my documents. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me.
Thank you, Dr. Carley. And you'll be taking calls and attempting to help parents of damaged kids and counsel them and that kind of thing?
Yes, I teach them what I would do if I was they. They took my medical license away from me because they claim I have a delusion of conspiracy. So now I teach people. They wanted me to undergo psychiatric drugging, institutionalization, or electroshock therapy so that I would have a chemical lobotomy and not be able to think anymore. So now I teach people, of parents, of children and pets as well. My protocol has worked for everything. And once people realize that, they'll understand that these inoculations are causing the corruption of the immune system that causes all autoimmune disease and cancer. And as a matter of fact, if David sends me an address, any snail mail address, I will be happy to send him a number of CDs of some of my other internet radio shows just for your consideration. I want anyone to please prove me wrong, because for me to realize what I now know, of course I have to understand that my profession is actually causing more death and disease than has ever happened with their inoculation.
And I have talked to some of Dr. Carley's legal team. I have seen the evidence. She is right on with what she is saying. Dr. Carley and David Kirby, thank you very much for being on the show. I'm going to leave by reading you something that I found online, and it's a quote from the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, where on the one hand, they're denying that there's any problem. On the other, they're putting this out, and this is the direct quote from their website. It's a program about adverse effects that are obvious, and some that include death. And this announcement even is death can be expected. So this is a deadline for filing about chickenpox and influenza and hepatitis B. And it's from Altum Maglio. For those who have been injured or lost a child from an adverse reaction to the hepatitis B, influenza type B, or chickenpox from a vaccination administered prior to August 6, 1997, the deadline for filing, and they give all of that, for filing a claim with the National Injury Compensation Program is fast approaching. Congress enacted this law in 1986 to compensate individuals and families of individuals suffering from adverse reactions to vaccines. Now, if there's not a problem, why did they set up this compensation program. And think, too, what is going on when the government would indemnify a personal private company, well, I guess it's a corporate company, indemnify them against any damage they do. That's crazy. And we, the people, need to take over and see that our children are not damaged without us having something to say about it. Till next time, this is Sound Health on BBS Radio.
The boy without a liver and the Indian giver, they've all got the main three blues. The lovers and the lawyers and the self-employer were in the foyer sipping glue, discussing.